Good morning. It is 10 past 7. I'm Hugh Remington. You're with Sunday Extra on RN. Some good news from the Middle East. It's been a long time coming. We're going to talk to legendary Australian war correspondent Michael Ware. Now strap in. Over the last 16 and a half years, Australian troops have been engaged, as we know, in war in Afghanistan, in Iraq and in Syria. We've been fighting first one designated enemy and then another. It may be true that most Australians long ago actually lost interest, but maybe it's time to look again, because in each of those three war zones right now, things are shifting. Michael Ware knows these conflicts well. As a correspondent for Time magazine and then for CNN, he quite literally lived those wars for years, developing such deep frontline experience. He was able to go on air and directly contradict the US president at the time about what was happening in key battles. Such courage and directness won him many admirers, although it must be said some powerful enemies as well. Well, Michael Ware is back home in Brisbane for a short stint, so I have grabbed him to bring us up to date. Michael, good morning.
Yeah, I consider this my fourth kidnapping here.
Anything that gets you up on a Sunday morning, Michael, it takes certain powers of persuasion, but look, we've got a lot to talk about, haven't we?
We certainly do, and we have limited time. I mean, once you get me started, mate, there's so much that the Australian public deserves to know about. And, you know, as you know, it's our obligation to tell them in very simple and clear terms about these incredibly complicated things around the world that are actually impacting on
us. Well, let's try and do our best. There's Iraq to talk about, Syria, Afghanistan. Let's talk about Iraq. That's where the good news is.
What is the good news? Really? Well, you've heard something that I haven't. Well, I mean, essentially, look, Iraq has not operated well, in inverted commas, in terms of its people. And that's in terms of the delivery of services and basically being able to sleep safe in your house at night, with the heavy caveat, as long as you weren't a political enemy. Iraq has not been so safe since Saddam. We destabilized Iraq, where it got to the point where there was a running joke in the first two inverted commas democratically elected elections that if Saddam, who was then a prisoner, had run, he probably would have won. So we've seen incredible destabilization of that ancient culture there since our invasion. And now it's finally finding its footing again. It's obviously doing so as an Iranian proxy state. But the current prime minister is one of the most savvy I think they've had for a while. So through different means, he's been able to stabilize the place.
Yeah, and he says that they've beaten IS.
Well, that's not true, but in effect, they've denied them most Iraqi territory.
Now, there have been warnings from the US military commander in there on the ground, or the most senior military guy still in Iraq from the US, saying that they might have defeated in the battle space IS, retaking Mosul and so on. But unless this Shia majority figures out some accommodation with Sunnis that gives them a place in modern Iraq, then there'll just be another IS, there'll be another Al-Qaeda in Iraq, there'll be another Sunni insurgency arising.
Of course it will. I mean, it looks good on the surface. I mean, as I say, best since Saddam. I mean, when you look beneath the surface, it wasn't really pleasant for a lot of people under Saddam. So it's such as the case today. And yes, you know, for our listeners, you know, in Islam, it's roughly akin to Catholic and Protestant, Sunni and Shia. And right now, the Protestants, the Shia, are in control and have been since we invaded. We gave control to the Shia and therefore indirectly and directly to the Iranians.
But that's a democratic reality, isn't it? I mean, there are more Shia than there are Sunnis.
Yeah, it's a majority Shia population. So you would expect to have a Shia-dominated government now. However, they've been very, very well guided in ways to consolidate power within first the office of the prime minister and then within separate security forces. And now we have, you know, legitimate paramilitary. So it's like having legitimate religious outlaw motorcycle clubs that another government backs that you unleash on New South Wales from Queensland, for example. So yes, all of that's deeply entrenched, and for now it's holding things together. But as long as they keep denying their Catholic or Sunni population, which they do, then yes, this will never, ever change. And quite frankly, it's all our own fault post-World War I. We created this anyway, and we shouldn't be surprised that it's never going to settle down.
Well, that was the positive aspect of it, Michael.
Yeah, that was the upside.
That's the best we've got to say about the region. But so let's move on to Afghanistan, where, of course, we lost most of those wars of the district. 41 of our troops died trying to make Afghanistan a better place. And yet the very latest report that's come out from the US Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction says that there has been a 50% increase in those parts of Afghanistan that are so-called under insurgent control since the end of 2015. The Taliban's coming back, isn't it?
I'm waiting for the news part of that, because that's not news.
Well, it's not unexpected, perhaps, but we're watching it happen.
Since I first arrived in Afghanistan shortly after 9/11, I arrived in the south, not from the north like everyone else, and I went straight to the birthplace of the Taliban in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. I got there the day after Mullah Omar, the deceased leader of the and founder of the Taliban, left. So I was, I guess, in an unfortunate yet fortunate place where I was living in such a situation. I was living with the Taliban the day after they stopped, inverted commas, being Taliban. So I knew the Taliban had never gone away, and I knew that the Taliban were never going to go away. And at the end of the day, they're much more of a Pashtun nationalist organisation than they are truly Islamist, and much more of an extension of Pakistani foreign policy and military policy than they are anything else. Now, as we just saw, the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, this week announced formally, what's secretly be going on under the table is that the Taliban is going to be welcomed back as a political party and a representative of the Pashtun population. Now, in all of this, we come back to ask about, was it worth 41 diggers' lives?
What's the now, answer?
In the end, I'll say yeah. I'll say definitely yes.
On what basis?
I'll treasure all 41 of those lives given. I went to, when I could, some of the funerals. And in all the embeds I've done around the world with Western and non-Western forces, I've never once embedded with the Aussies. But the sad reality is that the little province, let's call it, say, Southeast Queensland, that the Aussie troops went in to pacify and democratise and to bring girls to schools and all of this was never under their control, was never going to be under their control. And the instant we, you know, the mission, the coalition mission in that province, Rosegun, ended, it instantly reverted back to full-blown Taliban control. So the point was we were never going to change Rosegun province.
So why do you say that it was worth losing those lives if it was never going to change anything?
Because sometimes you've got to make a stand, mate.
But it's a temporary stand. If there's no...
So it doesn't matter. Sometimes you just got to stand and scream. And sometimes we've got to pay that with blood. Now, in one sense, we were doing the right thing. We were trying to help people. In a broader sense, that's not what we were there for at all. Helping people was just a side product, a byproduct. If it happened, it was a bonus. What we were really there for is to maintain our commitment to the American-led, you know, fight against global terrorism.
So then, if it's important to stand sometimes and scream, as you say, to make a stand, and that lives must be lost for that,
yeah,
that's one thing. It's another thing if, in fact, all it is a strategic piece of alliance maintenance.
Not all it is. Alliance maintenance is vital. And we have benefited more from our American alliance than arguably anyone since 2001. So I can be very dark and cynical and frank and strategic about how the wars on terror have actually served Australia's broader national strategic interests, in particular with regard to the now unprecedented closeness of our alliance with our big brother, the United States. That alone was worth it. The fact that maybe one Rosegunny girl got to go to school for a few years when she wouldn't have, simply because diggers were on the ridges of her valley, then that one girl makes it all worth it to me.
Let's move on to Syria.
Yeah.
Because that's where it really is.
Talk about stepping on a landmine. Yeah,
I mean, the UN called with much trumpeting the ceasefire a few days back. There's no evidence.
Yes, it's
all.
It's a lovely charade, isn't it? It's a lovely, lovely bit of theatre.
So what is happening there? I mean, the theatre of war. If you look at East Ghouta, which is just there to the east of Damascus, rebel-held enclave, about 400,000 people are in there, have been holding out for years.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just in the last few days, since the ceasefire was declared, two hospitals there.
600 have died, yeah.
Have been blown up, yeah. So what's happening? Is this an attempt to forge a final end game?
The end game's still unfolding. The first chapter of this great game, to pardon the Afghan reference, was dealing with ISIS. That was the excuse. Historically, we'll remember that was the reason this began. It's not going to be what defines what's happening. In essence, it was, at high cost, politically and in human terms, there was a successful campaign by competing and rival nation-state actors and groups on the ground to drive out the Islamic State from their territory. That has been achieved. The Islamic State now reverts back to its original DNA as a global terrorist organisation, which they always anticipated they would do, but we had to deny them the territory. Now, the cost of that is that Syria is blown apart, which means that the region is blowing apart, which means that global nation-state superpower actors are playing global nation-state superpower games there.
Well, to give you an example, we've obviously the Russians are involved, but if you look to the north there, the Kurds are holding this group, this little enclave called Afrin. They've been attacked over the border by the Turkish full regular army, the full military in there, which on the very latest reports, they are making progress into this Afrin district. The Kurds were being supported by the US. The Turks are part of NATO and therefore US allies. So you have two essential allies of the United States fighting each other there. How's that going to wind up?
Yeah, that could get ugly. It's certainly already tricky. And look, let's not underestimate the plight of the Kurds. I mean, those poor people have been screwed by history and actually since 1991, screwed by us at least four times, us of the West. And I want to reassure you, though, Hugh, the American administration knows this. The generals you and I knew in Iraq are now running the administration. I mean, General H.R. McMaster is now National Security Advisor. He fought the Battle of Talafar in 05. James Bulldog Mattis is Secretary of State. He was a Marine Corps general who sees Kandahar Airfield. General Mark Milley, Chief of Staff of the American Army, was in Ramadi, Petraeus, Odiano. It goes on and on. We know these people. These are the people who know this region and are dealing with this. Now, the Kurds, they know the place of the Kurds. The Kurds have been our single greatest, without question, ally in that region since 1991. The Kurds just want to be Kurds, and by and large, our interests align with theirs. However, no one else wants the Kurds to succeed. Iran doesn't want the Kurds to succeed, Turkey, Syria, or Iraq, because the Kurdish population bleeds into all those countries. And technically, Kurdistan is a part of Iraq, but really it is actually a separate country.
Are we going to abandon the Kurds again?
Of course we will. Of course we will. And you see that the Kurds have fought for us since 1991 against Saddam, in 2003 against the nascent Islamic State and against Saddam, and then they backed us up all through the wars, the Iraq War. Now, the Americans, not wanting to put real, significant conventional forces on the ground, have used the Kurds, the Syrian Defense Forces and the Kurds, who we've armed and backed and trained and we've supported with close air support. Meanwhile, Turkey's backing another mob of Kurds. There's another mob of Kurds who are so sort of radical it's hard to get a finger on them. In the meantime, so you have other Turkish-backed rebel forces, you have, government rebel forces, you have within the Islamist coalition in the last 72 hours a fracture. What used to be al-Qaeda in Syria is changed its name and now it's created a new coalition which it's fighting against other Islamist elements, and it's so confusing, and the Kurds are stuck in the middle of it because we're
running out of time, Michael. We could go
I told
on
you we were going to. Really?
Lovely it is to talk to you, Michael, but how depressing it is, as it seems always
to
be.
It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be, because I have faith. I mean, you know, humanity is dark and light. Australia is only a middle power, but all of us, humanity and Australia, I believe, can punch above our weight.
Well, let's see, Michael Ware. Great to talk to you today, as always.
Thanks, man.